Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you all to the Supreme Court hearing room today. And we have a special welcome for students who are here. And we have three different groups of students. One is the Agape School. Would those students please stand? Thank you very much for coming. You may be seated. We have Albany High School students. Would they stand, please? And thank you all for coming. And we also have the University of Wisconsin Law School students with their professor, Lewis Butler. Would that group please stand? Thank you very much for coming. What class is it? Okay, thank you. The high school students are here with a program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students from around the state are invited to come to the hearing room, listen to an oral argument, and then meet with a justice after the second oral argument. And at that meeting, the discussion is on the procedure of the court, procedure in accepting a case and the procedure in deciding a case. The discussion will not be on the substantive issues of the case. The University of Wisconsin Law School students come because they have identified a case that the class is theoretically interested in, and we welcome them too, and everyone, including the law students, are welcome to stay for the discussion with the justice. The marshal has a summary of the case we are about to hear. And if you would like a summary of the facts and legal issue, would you raise your hand and we'll get it to you, Marshall, on this side. It's just very much easier to understand it if you've got some factual background. And while I think there's also a typographical error in your summary. Are you giving them the summary that the court, that the clerk's office puts out? There's a reference in the third paragraph from the bottom to section 383.63. Yes. It should be 283.63. I'm just calling that to your attention. Let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson. I'm the Chief Justice. And to my left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And Justice Crooks is the justice who will meet with you all at lunch today. Seated next to Justice Crooks is Justice Patience Rogensack. And at the end is Justice Michael Gableman. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her right, Justice David Prosser, and on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. I always check at the end to make sure everybody is here or explain why a chair is empty. With those introductions made, I will now turn to our second case of the day, 08 AP 3235, Kurt Anderson versus Department of Natural Resources. Arguing on behalf of the Department of Natural Resources is Assistant Attorney General Joanne Kloppenberg. Counsel, you may proceed.
Is the court? I am Assistant Attorney General Joanne Kloppenberg from the Department of Justice, representing...
Ms. Kloppenberg, your voice is very soft, so if you can get as close to the microphone as possible, that would be helpful to the court.
Okay. I am representing the Department of Natural Resources, and with me at council table is DNR attorney Margaret Hafer. The council has sued to be able to ask an administrative law judge in a state permit review proceeding to directly apply general federal rules promulgated by EPA under the Clean Water Act to a state wastewater discharge permit that fully complies with state rules in a state program approved by EPA as being consistent with federal law. The Court of Appeals decision in the Council's favor will create chaos in the state law permitting program. It contravenes state statutes, and it ignores the proper remedies available, whereas here a party believes that state rules don't go far enough or fast enough, and that federal rules should require a different result.
Ms. Kloppenburg,
yes.
Why would it cause chaos? I'm having some trouble understanding that.
Well, let me give an example why it would cause chaos. The direct answer is that it would circumvent the rulemaking process and result in piecemeal applications of standards that should be rules applying to everyone on a permit-by-permit review basis, and it also would not provide not only consistency, but also finality for permittees in the public. And the municipal amici's example will help, I think, everyone understand this. A comprehensive rule package for setting numeric standards for phosphorus is about to go into effect in Wisconsin. After several years of input and final agreement by the whole range of stakeholders, EPA and the participants in this case included, those rules include a phased implementation plan that is not in federal regulations, reflecting the steep cost to certain point sources of achieving those new standards. When DNR issues permits to those point sources, can a petitioner require DNR to reevaluate the implementation part of the rules in the permit as not being consistent with federal law, thereby undercutting the entire rule package and all of the expectations emanating from it? The Court of Appeals decision gives a fresh opportunity to whomever is unhappy with the outcome of the program-wide rulemaking process. There would be no finality. The Court of Appeals decision lets anyone go before the state administrative law judge and say that the state rules resulting from the rulemaking process are not tough enough or fast enough or expensive enough, and ask the ALJ to disagree with the many people who spent years developing the rules. The Court of Appeals decision asks the ALJ to change permit terms taken from state rules, resulting in improper rulemaking. The permit terms at issue in this case are, in fact, the challenge to those terms are a collateral attack on the rules after they've been promulgated, the permit terms at issue here.
And counsel, before you go further, the rules that were promulgated and applied by the DNR in this instance have already been approved by the EPA. Is that true?
Not precisely in this case. At the time the permit was issued, the phosphorus rules had, but the mercury rule, which is a procedural rule, it's a variance to the DNR's general rule regarding toxics. There was a variance that had not yet been approved by EPA.
Did the EPA have the opportunity to object to the permits issued here?
Yes.
And did they object?
No, they did not. And what I don't believe there's anything in the record showing that the council or anyone asked the EPA to object on any grounds, including the ground that the permit includes a term taken from our rules that is inconsistent with federal
law. And is there a time period? Is there an opportunity for someone to object after notification that a permit is going to be issued?
There is a time period for asking EPA to object. And if you miss that step, if EPA disregards your request and doesn't object, then you have several avenues of recourse. The most limited is to seek some kind of federal judicial review of EPA's failure to object. We admit it's a very limited review under the Federal Administrative Procedures Act. You have to show arbitrary and capricious conduct on behalf of EPA. It's arguable you could, where they ignored a clear rule that's not consistent with theirs. But more importantly, this isn't a permit-specific issue. The permit terms here are general DNR rules. It's a phosphorus limit and an approach to phosphorus at that time that is in the rules and is taken in every permit. It's an approach to mercury that at the time was in the rules and was taken in every permit. The challenge here is that when DNR responded to the Council's concerns about these terms, they said, under state law, we cannot change. We cannot do what you want to do under state law. So they then, in a contested case hearing situation, wanted the ALJ to reach out over state law directly to general federal law provisions. These are not objective provisions that the Council is referring to in this case. They wanted the DNR to undertake two kinds of analyses. One analysis is called the reasonable potential, and it evaluates whether the discharge will violate water quality standards. It's a process. It's an analysis that the state can determine in what circumstances it will undertake that analysis. And in Wisconsin, they said, we won't undertake that analysis unless there are water quality standards that might have been exceeded. And at that time, when this permit was issued, there were no water quality standards for phosphorus, either state or federal. And that had been approved by EPA. They approved those conditions on that analysis. The second analysis this council wanted the state to undertake was called an anti-degradation analysis. That, too, it's an approach. It's a policy. In the federal cases cited by the amici for the council, they refer to this anti-degradation provision in federal law as a policy. It's a policy. And the Congress gave EPA the discretion as to how to achieve the ends of that policy, no degradation of our waters. And EPA, in turn, has given that discretion to the states and, again, approved the conditions that DNR has put on undertaking that analysis. The conditions here are whether there is any new pollutant discharged or an increase in discharge. And the way increase in discharge is defined in our rules, it's an exceedance of a current effluent limit in a permit. The discharge here, from a layperson's perspective, was increased. They're discharging more phosphorus, even though it's at the same concentration as before. But they weren't exceeding any permit limits, and therefore it didn't trigger an anti-degradation analysis under state law.
Well, then you've gotten to the substance. Let's just get to, right?
Yes.
Let's get to what your basic point is. Is your basic point that in a permit challenge, and you agree that they should have a contested hearing here. You're not debating that, right?
On their state law challenges.
I understand
that,
but they have a right to a contested hearing.
Correct, under 283.
What you're debating, if I understand this case, is what can be raised at that hearing. And if I understand your position, it is only state law issues.
Correct, Your Honor. That is my position.
And that means you cannot raise, that is, the counsel here, cannot raise at that contested hearing issues that this permit violates federal law. Is that your position?
Correct.
Right. And that would be your position whether the federal law that was being raised was reasonable, potential, or whether it's anti-degradation, or anything else, right?
Correct.
Anything.
Correct.
Well, here's, as I understand, the legal problem.
Okay.
We agree that you can get a contested hearing under 283.63. When I say you, I'm talking about the council. Okay. Now, the council says, what is the DNR talking about? because under 283.313, the department may issue a permit, right?
Correct.
For discharge of a pollutant or combination. That's what we're under, right?
Correct.
Okay. And then that permit, the conditions that the permit puts on for discharge have to meet the statutory standards, A, B, C. They're not in dispute, right?
Correct.
Okay. D is in dispute, right?
Correct.
And D says any more stringent limitations, including those, and then two. Any more stringent limitations, including those necessary to comply with any applicable federal law or regulation. Right?
Correct.
And it is my understanding, just so we understand what the debate here is about, so I can understand it, you are saying that applicable federal law or regulation under 2 refers only to special laws that the feds have passed or regulations the feds have passed relating to particular states and particular bodies of water. What's that called?
Overpromulgation.
Overpromulgation.
Yeah, correct.
Which must mean that the feds have promulgated something over and above, right?
Correct.
Okay. And my and that's how you interpret applicable federal law or regulation, right? Is that right?
Correct.
And it's your position there are no over-promulgation rules applicable here.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
So D2 falls out.
Correct.
Under your interpretation, therefore only state law, right?
Correct.
Okay. It's the council's position, if I understand it, that the plain language of this statute says applicable federal law or regulation. It doesn't say overpromulgation. It doesn't say special laws applicable to Wisconsin, right?
Correct.
And says, therefore, they are entitled to bring up any applicable federal law or regulation in the contested hearing. Is that the fight?
That's correct. That's the crux of our dispute.
That's right.
Is there anything else you're fighting about? I know that you fought about other things in the trial court or in the Court of Appeals, but my understanding is that's the only thing before us now.
That's right. And the state, the DNR, has consistently interpreted the way 281.31 works to gradually narrow itself down so that by the time you get to the subdivision D2, you're talking about a very narrow set of specifically applicable federal regulations. And you get there because the government, the U.S. government itself, in 40 CFR 131.21, makes it clear that state law applies unless a specific federal rule applies. And I won't quote that language here because it will use up my time. But it makes it very clear that once EPA has approved a program, the state rules prevail unless EPA promulgates over those rules. If the broad reading that the council would make of this statute were to prevail, then the subdivision would swallow the program, and it would make state rules a subordinate stepsister rather than a primary partner of the Clean Water Act and of EPA. And the reason is DNR has gone through, as this phosphorus rule exercise has shown, an arduous rulemaking process that includes all the stakeholders. If a petitioner could bypass those rules and demand direct compliance with general federal law, as if those rules never existed, then that would create chaos, and there would be no reason for the rules to exist.
Can the state promulgate rules that conflict with the federal rules, and that say they do, and then the EPA doesn't say anything, right? The EPA is not required to slap the state's hands, right?
That's correct.
EPA has a lot of discretion And if, right?
Right. And if that happened, then the proper recourse is to get the rules changed. Under 283.63(5), it says that the rules, water quality standards, which are the rules at issue here that were passed, promulgated under 281.15, both the all of the rules challenged by the council fall into that category. Those rules can't be reviewed in a contested case hearing under 283.63.
Wait,
the statute
you,
says that.
Where?
283.63(5).
Okay. But you've got another statute that says that regulates issuing permits.
Pardon?
You have another statute that says the department may issue permits and limits the department in issuing a permit. And that says any applicable federal law. So I understand the department's view that you are attacking a rule in a contested hearing, but this statute seems to say okay.
But when the legislature spoke in 283.63(5), it made it clear that if your concern is with the rules, that the rules don't get us where the petitioners believe we should be, then you can request EPA or send them a notice of intent to sue to require EPA, to require the DNR to change its rules, as the council and others did for both phosphorus and mercury. It shows their avenues of relief. The process works. They went to EPA. EPA came back to Wisconsin, and Wisconsin made the changes that were necessary to continue having an approved program. You can also initiate rulemaking under 227.12.
Bobberg, let me interrupt you at this point.
Sure.
And ask you something that is of concern to me. How long has the position of DNR been in place in regard to the contested hearing and whether or not you can bring this up or can't bring it up?
Well, the DNR has always held that position. It was never tested until around the time
Is a long, long time. Now. Come on.
Well, since the statute was in place, since the 70s, if there was a contested case hearing on a permit, it was always pursuant to state law.
So are you claiming that there is great weight deference that is due to the DNR position?
Yes, I am. And I am for a number of reasons. On the record, we only have – the council is right that this was one of the very first times the DNR's position was tested on the record. Since – in early 2006, late 2005, early 2006. Since then, there have been a spate of similar challenges on the record, and those proceedings were attached to the state's reply brief. And in each time, the DNR held to the same position, and it is a position that DNR has held off the record informally since it began administering the permitting program, and now has only recently been tested. And it is due great weight deference because it is the agency charged with administering this program.
Is that the basis of your great weight deference in large part because it's the agency charged with administration of program as opposed to informally or off the record we have a long history?
It is the former plus the fact that they've been consistent since it's been tested.
Say the last part again.
They've held this position consistently since they have been tested
record. This is one of the first on-the-record contests.
Correct.
I don't know if our jurisprudence says that if this is one of the first ones contested, the fact that they continue to hold it should allow us to give it great weight deference. I mean, that's not necessarily in tune with the premise that it's been of long standing on the record.
But it helps to show that what they have done informally since they have begun implementing the permitting program in the 70s has been to limit permit review proceedings to state law issues. Because if they did not, they would run afoul of the 283.63(5) prohibition on hearing challenges to rules, because it would subvert the rulemaking process. It would require a piecemeal permit by permit second guessing of EPA's approval of the program.
Counselor, I see how you get into the argument under subsection 5 about not being able to challenge a rule promulgated under 281, but that assumes that what they are doing is challenging a rule. And when I read their argument, I thought it sounded like though the DNR may have correctly applied state law, there was federal law that was being impacted in a negative way by the way in which the state was applying state law, and they wanted to present that evidence. Is that, am I right or wrong on that?
That may be what they're saying, but that's not actually what's happening.
Okay. It's correct. Well, I may have misunderstood too, okay. So that's what I'm trying to get straightened out.
Look at the second sentence. The application of rules promulgated under 15 may be reviewed under this section.
May not be.
May not. But I need an answer to my
second
question,
please.
I'm sorry. They're trying to bootstrap onto a permit a change in DNR's approach and DNR's rules. They want DNR to change its definitions and its conditions on how you implement these analyses. The analyses provide no more guidance in federal law. They're the same. So they're trying to reach out and ask EPA to tell DNR to interpret those provisions differently in their state rules.
Okay. If in fact there were a DNR rule, and I understand you think they're not really getting to the merits, so this is just a hypothetical. If there were a DNR rule that when applied to a particular permit, did run afoul of a federal law, okay, what would be the forum where they could bring that if they can't bring it in a contested case hearing?
They can seek a declaratory ruling under 227.40 sub 1 in state court. They can go, as they did here, go straight to EPA and say, EPA, you make DNR change its rules. They also went to DNR. DNR was actually had started this new phosphorus rulemaking process.
Changing the rules may not be a valid approach if it's just this one permit where there's a problem. In other words, the rules may function well in regard to other permits.
If they want DNR to change the way it implements its rules with respect to this permit.
No. My hypothetical is very specific.
Right.
The rules were correctly applied by DNR, the state law rules. But in this particular hypothetical permit, that application of the rule violates a federal law, okay? Or it arguably does. Where would they be able to argue that? And you're telling me they could bring a declaratory judgment in circuit court.
Against the rule.
Okay, so they don't have to go through any... No, not against the rule. I'm talking against the application of a rule.
But they're one and the same here. Look
at the second sentence of 5. The first sentence says, rules may not be reviewed under this section. The second sentence says, the application of rules promulgated may be reviewed in a contested hearing.
Right,
and Justice Rosenzweig keeps asking you about the application. The second sentence says something different than the first sentence upon which you relied.
But the challenge here to the application of the rules is the challenge to the rule itself. There is no way to apply the rules the way they want, the rules to be applied, in this case, to this permit without changing the rules. It's clear they don't meet these conditions. There's no other way around state law to apply the rule. The rule is... can't be applied any differently.
But that's the merits. That's the merits. And if I were the hearing examiner hearing a contested case hearing and they're saying, I want to bring this evidence in to show that the application of this rule violates federal law, I think that's as far as we are here. And my concern is they should have a forum to do that.
But they do, and they can ask EPA to object to the permit, or they have to change the rules. Here, if the ALJ required DNR to apply, I'll answer this question if that's okay, to apply the rule the way they wanted to, the ALJ would have to actually change the rule. They'd have to change the definitions. They'd have to change the conditions.
And so, therefore, when they try to do that, they really aren't showing that the rule is being implied incorrectly. They are really challenging the rule. And I think you would fall under the section that you answered the Chief Justice's question with. But my concern is, shouldn't that be a decision that's first made? In other words, what they're trying to do really is challenge the rule. What they're really not doing is challenging the application.
I have, I think, a hypothetical that, that you're trying to ask me.
Okay.
All right. Is, say the phosphorus limit is 1.
Okay.
Okay. And EPA changes it and says, states generally now the rule has to, the limit has to be 0.8.
Okay.
And DNR issues, doesn't change its rules.
Right.
And issues a permit that has 0.1 in it.
Okay.
Okay? And the council says, this violates the federal rules because you're supposed to be 0.8.
Right.
In that case, they have to go to EPA because EPA has approved our program. They have to go to DNR, say, initiate rulemaking, change your rule because this is of general application. It applies to everyone. Okay. Like in the WEPCO case, if an ALJ in a permit directly imported the federal standard into a permit, they'd be violating the rulemaking process in Wisconsin. So even in that case, which I think is, well, it's sort of challenging the rule again, as well as the application, I guess, so saying it's directly violates federal rules, it's DNR to keep EPA's approval, which the state wants. The state wants DNR, not EPA, to administer this program and enforce these permits.
Sure.
They have to go to DNR directly, initiate rulemaking, say, change this rule, or they go to EPA and they say, EPA, make DNR, change this rule, or withdraw your approval of the program. They can't do that through the permit, through a permit by permit by permit review process.
So what you're telling me is there can't be any application of Wisconsin law that could ever violate a federal law.
Oh, it can, but it can't be reviewed in a state permit proceeding. It has to be.
Well, if the EPA reviewed it, then could they say this permit has to be withdrawn?
Oh, yes. They can object, and they have. One of the older cases, the 1989 Paper Institute case, EPA objected to a slew of permits that DNR issued, and DNR, to keep control of the program, changed those permits accordingly. But they did it by changing the state rules. In the mercury example here, when EPA said the variance procedure that required 12 samples,
right.
You can't, when they said you can't do that, DNR said, okay, we will revert to our general reasonable potential rule for toxics. They didn't say, okay, we will follow a federal rule out there. They said, we will scratch this rule and follow one of our other more general rules to cover the situation. Always they're going back to state law in their permits.
Okay. All right. I think I understand better. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just some questions.
I understand the issue to be, does the DNR have authority in a WISSTAT 28363 hearing to determine whether the terms of a proposed WPDES permit comply with federal requirements of the Clean Water Act? Is that your understanding of the issue?
The issue is whether an ALJ can, I think so, except it's not proposed at this point. It has been issued. It's an issued permit. It's no longer proposed. And the permit has been issued. And you cannot challenge the terms in that permit by saying they violate federal law.
I mean, isn't it the challenge, as I understand, is they're challenging the terms of the permit, not the rule. They're challenging the terms of the permit and whether or not it complies with federal law. That's what I understand their argument to be.
I understand. That's their argument. But in fact, when those terms comply with state rules, in a program that has been approved by EPA, they have to be challenging the rules themselves because, in this case, the phosphorus rule was plucked right from the phosphorus term was just taken whole from the rule. The mercury term was taken whole from the rule. The rules are the terms in the permit. And for them to challenge the terms, if they're saying, and they have said the terms comply with state law, the rules, then they have to be challenging the rules. They are not challenging the terms.
So your logic is the permit rules, first you have the rules. They've been approved by EPA. Then you have permits with conditions, and those conditions comply with state law.
Correct.
Well, that may be challenged, but if they comply with state law. They comply with state law. Your position is they automatically apply with federal law because the state law has been approved by the feds.
That's the presumption.
That's right. And that when you attack the terms of the permit, and the permit has been complies with state law, you are attacking the rule.
Correct.
Because the permit equals the rule.
Correct.
Therefore, I mean, that's your position. Permit equal the rule. Therefore, you can't attack the rule under 263.11, whatever it is, right?
Yes.
What you're doing, you say you're attacking the application, but you're really attacking the rule, and it falls under the first sentence of subsection 5.
Correct, Your Honor.
May I ask one question?
Certainly.
Here there are third parties seeking to get something. How does your interpretation affect the rights of permittees or potential permittees?
I think it affects everyone. Well, it provides, our argument provides certainty and consistency and finality for the permittees. They know once the rules have been passed, they know what to expect, and they know what's going to be in their permits. If in a permit proceeding, permit review proceeding, the ALJ can just reach out to general federal law and bootstrap it into a state permit and bypass the rules and the rulemaking process, that leaves the permittees hanging. And so the permittees are, it is important for their interests and their planning and their budgeting to be able to rely on the rules that they know will be put in the permits. Just like it's important for the public to know what's in the rules, because if they don't like what's in the rules, that's the time for them to challenge. In the rulemaking process, make their voices heard to get a rule that they find acceptable, knowing that it's going to be plunked down in state permits.
Go ahead.
These third parties are seeking greater latitude. Challenge something than DNR would like.
Well, I think they want the DNR to hold the line on the review of federal law issues in contested case hearings. It's the council that wants something broader.
Oh, that's what I'm saying.
Mickey, I thought you meant.
The council seems to be seeking greater latitude.
Not for the permittees. They want the entire Code of Federal Regulations to be looked at afresh every time a permit is issued to see whether any one of those provisions in that code might be being violated by a permit term.
The council here wants the DNR to be stricter than the permittee wants it. Isn't that right here?
Stricter than their own rules allow them to be.
I understand that, but they want the DNR, in this case, to enforce stricter rules about pollutants than the permittee wants.
They want DNR to undergo analyses that might result in stricter. We don't know.
That's a much better way of phrasing that. In a contested hearing, the permittee will be heard too, right?
Correct.
And the third parties will be heard.
Correct.
So everybody gets in to a discussion.
You revisit the rulemaking all over again.
Well, I understand that's your position.
Right.
Someone else might take the position that what you're doing is debating about the application of the rules and whether the permit conditions are correct.
Correct.
Okay. So what is the
283.63 allows third parties to come in and say to the permittee and to the DNR, this permit's no good.
Right? That's right.
It gives standing to strangers.
Yes.
The strangers being, in effect, five people, the public, who says the DNR is or is not strict enough.
Correct.
Okay.
And
that's what a contested hearing means.
Right, that is. Okay, my time is up.
May I just try once more? It seems to me the third parties here are seeking greater procedural latitude to attack a permit.
You're right, Your Honor. They accuse DNR of doing a power grab, but they want the whole of general federal law to be able to apply anew every time a permit is issued, outside of the rulemaking process, outside of the relief they might have to EPA. They're the ones who are expanding the potential reach of DNR through the ALJ.
To the extent that you curtail the procedural latitude of third parties, do you also curtail the procedural latitude of a permittee?
The permittee similarly has the same recourse, can go to EPA, can go to DNR through the rulemaking procedure. And the phosphorus rulemaking process is such a good example because it exemplifies the tension. The permittees feel one way, the citizens, DNR, EPA all feel the other way. And they have now come up with a rule package that to which everyone has agreed, and that's and will have new phosphorus standards, and that's the way you make rules that turn into terms in our wastewater discharge permits. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kloppenberg. Attorney Carol Sindebrand, representing the petitioner, Kurt Anderson.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Carl Sindebrand. I'm a partner at Axley Brynelson, representing Kurt Anderson et al., the initial petitioners in this matter. I am joined at a council table with Elizabeth Lawton, my co-counsel. I would like to first identify those points I want to discuss today and hopefully in the process respond to Ms. Kloppenberg's points, because I think she muddies the water and makes something that really is fairly straightforward under the statutes rather complex. And I think she does that by creating creative interpretations that don't exist in the statutes, ignoring statutes which are pertinent and yet not even identified in her brief, and with respect to what is the appropriate forum, a critical case here, a question here, ignoring the most applicable federal law out of the Seventh Circuit, which says unequivocally there is no access to federal courts to review either EPA's declining to review a state-issued permit or EPA's review and decision not to object to a state permit. That's the American Paper Institute case in 890 Fed Second from 1989. It is unequivocal. We've cited it numerous times. It's not even in the state's briefs except for a very minor boilerplate provision. So those are some of the defects in the state's case. But let me first say what I think the issues here are, or I don't think there's a dispute over what the issues are, but what are the points I need to make? First of all, as a matter of state law, when DNR issues a WPDES permit, it must comply with the applicable requirements of state law, of federal law, excuse me. That is not only in Section 283.31, sub 3, sub D. It is also in Section 283.13, subsection 5. Secondly, the Wisconsin citizens and public interest groups who requested the contested case hearing here are entitled to contest and have an ALJ, an administrative law judge, determine whether the permit here meets that state statutory requirement to comply with the minimum applicable requirements of federal law. And I'll get into what applicable means in a couple moments. Thirdly, the contested case hearing process in Section 283.63 is available and it is adequate to address the issues in this case on the merits. It is the only mechanism available for citizens to obtain a decision from an independent decision maker and the only opportunity to have access to the courts to address these issues on a record that has been developed before the agency. And I assure you that if we did not request a hearing here, DNR would likely be arguing that we had not exhausted our administrative remedies. And they would be right. That's what the Padger Paper Mills case says. That's what the federal Froebel case with its companion state court case say.
Counsel, can I ask you just two sort of preliminary questions? One, how is yours a challenge to the application of the rule and not the rule itself?
That's an important question.
My second, because sometimes things shift along the way and don't get back to me. So the second question I have is, DNR issues a permit. Let's just assume they issued it under the existing rules. Everyone agrees they're the rules in place at the time. Then the EPA changes the rules. What happens with the issued permit? Can that be challenged under what are new rules? Or does the permittee get to go ahead and function, you know, in the building or standard or industry or machinery or whatever it was that they did to comply with the permit that was issued? Do you have the two?
Yes, I do. And if I can just comment on the second point, that is not the issue we have here. The federal rules have been in existence in some form since at least 1977. So that's not an issue here, but I will address it. We need to have a little understanding of what the rules are here, and I know it's at least touching on the merits, but it's important here. There are two ways that a state can issue water quality standards. Sorry, Justice. One is to issue water quality standards that are numerical, and the other is to issue water quality standards that are narrative. In this case, when we're dealing with phosphorus and mercury, we're dealing with narrative water quality standards. And that says that when DNR issues a permit, it has to include effluent limits, numerical limits in the permit, so that there will be no discharge of substances that will cause objectionable deposits, that will cause floating or submerged debris, that will result in toxicity, that will, in essence, impact the values of that stream. That is called a narrative water quality standard, and that's really all the state standard says here with respect to phosphorus, which is the first issue. Now, our position is there is absolutely nothing wrong with that rule. But when DNR applies that rule in a given permit, it has to develop permit conditions complying with that rule that also comply with federal law. And what federal law says in this issue is that before you issue a permit, you have to do what's called a reasonable potential analysis. You have to actually examine DNR, do your homework, and determine whether this proposed discharge without a separate water quality limit will cause violation of that water quality standard, that narrative standard. If the answer is yes, then you have to include a numerical limit in the permit. If the answer is no, then you don't. All we've asked for is to challenge this permit because DNR failed to go through that process, which we believe would have likely resulted in the issuance of a permit with a more stringent limit than what we call the categorical or technology-based limits, the ones that apply to everybody regardless of what stream you're discharging to. So we're not talking about either a conflict between federal and state law or a challenge to any state regulation. And Ms. Kloppenberg's premise that Chief Justice articulated that regulation equals permit is not correct. We do not just mechanically apply the regulation. The regulation says the limit 6, it goes in the permit. That's not how this system works, and a review of those regulations, particularly NR 102.04, leads us to that necessary conclusion. And so there is no disharmony in what we're saying, and there is no inconsistency with the rule, and what the statute requires is you got to meet the minimum requirements of federal law. Now, what happens when you issue a permit that complies with federal law, and then EPA changes the law, or Congress changes the law? I've been representing DNR for 30 years, and I've had a number of experiences in this, some good, some not so good. But what typically happens is DNR notifies either the permittee to whom it applies or the communities of permittees to whom it applies, if it's a rule, and says, we're going to have to modify your permit. As soon as this federal law comes into being and becomes applicable, we're going to have to modify your permit so that we remain consistent with federal law. And while state permits...
Even if the rule says something else? Even if the rule was consistent with the old standard?
Then there has to be both a... There typically would have to be, at least in theory, both a rule change and a permit change. And those rule changes, to the extent they happen, which is extremely rare, happen as emergency rules. Because when EPA is promulgating a new rule, number one, it takes a long time. And number two, there is always a transition period. So we will promulgate a rule that's effective January 1st, 2011, and permits have to be reissued by January 1st, 2012 to incorporate this. The federal agencies and the state agencies understand the complexity of this, and there's no aha gotcha type of issue associated with that. Another important point that I'd like to make is this. The purpose of Section 283.63 and the purpose of Chapter 227 is to provide citizens, be they permittees or others, with access to hearings and ultimately to court. And my concern, an important public policy concern here, is that DNR is using those provisions as a barrier to insulate itself and elude review. Now, the last general point I want to make, I think, directly addresses Justice Prosser's last set of questions to Ms. Kloppenburg. The precedent established by this court will cut both ways and insulate DNR from scrutiny by permittees alleging overregulation as well as those alleging inadequate regulation. And it may, in fact, be worse for permittees for this reason. State law, I'll paraphrase it very briefly, says that DNR must meet the minimum requirements of federal law, with some limited exceptions, and cannot be more stringent than federal law, again, with some exceptions. For someone who is claiming that DNR is more stringent than federal law, EPA doesn't care. They're happy to have state law be more stringent than federal law. Federal law is the baseline, the bare minimum that applies to all states. So, if a party is claiming you've issued a permit that exceeds the requirement of federal law, DNR would say, in line with the theory that they're presenting today, that is not a justiciable controversy before a state administrative hearing or before a state court, because it involves the interpretation of federal law, and we're hands off on applying federal law. So it really cuts both ways. Now, I want to also explain what this case is not about. We are not challenging any administrative rule, whether it applies to phosphorus or whether it applies to mercury. This is not a challenge to state law. It is not a challenge to state rules. Those rules provide DNR adequate authority to implement the state program, complying with state law that requires compliance with federal law, and complying with the applicable regulations themselves. We are also not arguing on the merits. This is not a question of how do these federal rules apply. It is a question of whether an administrative law judge can decide that they apply at all and then how they apply.
Counsel, I understand that argument and understand it in light of your explanation of the Clean Water Act and how it applies here with, what's your views, numerical versus narrative. But suppose I would assume that you could have a different kind of rule at the state level, right? Not a narrative rule.
Correct.
And that the permit might violate a numerical rule that may have been, can the EPA put in a numerical rule?
EPA has promulgated numerical rules,
okay,
both for categories of sources and to a very, very limited extent for water quality.
Okay. So you could have a federal numerical rule. The permit might be issued in violation of that federal rule, right?
Correct.
And the rule might violate the federal rule.
Correct.
Then aren't you, in effect, not looking at the application of the rule, but a challenge is to the very rule itself?
That could happen.
That's right. And so how, in writing a decision of the court, do you explain that you're under, that you can't get under sentence one in sub five, but you can get under sentence two, which is what I think you're doing? Maybe I'm wrong, then you can tell me.
I missed the very last point of your question, Your Honor. I apologize.
Oh, my question said under 263, sub 5, what was it?
Yes, I understand
11,
your
5.
Question.
You've sure. got two sentences which say, one, you can't review a rule in a contested hearing.
Yes.
But two, you can review the application. And your point here is this is application.
Correct.
And my question says, but you can have some times where it's the rule itself, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And state law provides the mechanism for that, and it is the only opportunity. And let me walk you through how that happens. And then we'll get to the question, which I understood beforehand that you were going to ask, and that is how should – what would you like us to say in our decision? 283.63 says you can challenge any permit condition. 283.63.5 says if the rule has been promulgated under 281.15, which is most but not all of the water quality standards. There are water quality standards promulgated under other rules as well, under statutes as well. But you cannot challenge the validity of the rule in the hearing, but you can challenge its application. So how do you get to court to challenge that rule? There are two opportunities, at least, under Section 227.40, which is the General Administrative Procedures Act. One is you can bring an independent action to challenge the rule. Two, you can challenge the rule on judicial review if you have raised it before the administrative law judge. The way I reconcile and read those two provisions in concert, and the way in my experience that it has been done, is that you raise the issue before the administrative law judge in your challenge to the permit, and the administrative law judge acknowledges that you've raised it, but he or she can't really decide that issue. But at least you've preserved it for judicial review after the hearing is completed and the permit is issued. And if the issuance of the permit satisfies the parties or moots the issue, then there's nothing to appeal. And if one of the parties appeals it and that remains an issue, then it is cognizable under Chapter 227.57 within that scope of review. So there are at least those two mechanisms for challenging a rule if we were going to challenge a rule. Now, what would I like the court to how would I like the court to resolve this?
Let me stop you just
yes, Your Honor.
Before you go on. Okay, you're telling me you're not challenging a rule, and I got that part of your argument, that the permit is not really totally coextensive with the rule, that
correct.
There are differences. Okay. And then you tell us, well, if you were challenging a rule under 227.40, how you'd go about doing that, okay? But you're telling us you're only challenging the application of a rule.
Correct.
So we don't need to be concerned about 227.40 if we don't think that the rule and the permit are coextensive, correct?
It would be dictum if you addressed it in this case.
Oh, you know, we say we never do dictum.
Touché, Your Honor.
All right, but your focus is not on our worrying about challenging a rule and how to go about it.
You are correct. Yes, okay. You're correct.
All right, just so I'm clear. Okay, go ahead.
What I would like the court to acknowledge is that under Chapter 283, and we can look at 283.001 and 283.11 and 283.13, which specifically deals with effluent limitations to comply with any federal requirement. 283.31, there's a host of them. They all focus on when DNR administers this program, it has to comply with the applicable provisions of federal law. And the applicable provisions of federal law do not require any interpretive machinations or limiting or expanding what the term applicable means. Applicable has a simple dictionary definition. It applies. EPA has told us which federal regulations apply. It's in 40 CFR, Part 123, Section 123.25. And it says to states, if you want to be a delegated state, these are the conditions, these are the portions of federal EPA rules that you have to meet. Two of those are 40 CFR Part 1, Section 122.44 and Section 122.45. They are expressly listed in that not very long laundry list of what has to be in a state program. And those are the regulations that we are turning to that say you, when water quality standards, numeric or narrative, are at risk or are in question, you have to do the reasonable potential analysis. And if that reasonable potential analysis shows that you're going to violate the water quality standard, you have to include an effluent limitation that satisfies that standard. There's nothing complex about this. It doesn't require us to interpret what the word applicable mean. Section 283.13 sub 5 does not even use the word applicable. It just says any other federal law. And so it is a red herring to go through this what does applicable mean analysis. It's just not relevant here.
Mr. Sinderbrand, so,
yes, sir.
As I understand Ms. Kloppenberg's argument, what you're trying to do has not been done before.
I beg your pardon,
sir? What you're trying to do has not been done before, if I understand her argument. How do you respond to that?
Ms. Kloppenberg, it happens in this court sometimes that counsel talk about facts that are outside the record. I understand this. Ms. Kloppenberg asserts to this court that this has always been DNR's interpretation, that we don't address federal law. My experience is otherwise, but I don't want to get into an evidentiary debate with Ms. Kloppenberg, even though I started at Justice before her. But the important point here is that when Ms. Kloppenberg submitted the evidence or a record to show its precedent and its longstanding interpretation, this case is the very first one. To my knowledge, this is the first time DNR has ever said we will not evaluate the extent to which our permit complies with federal law. And I have to tell you that that is contrary to the way DNR does business, and it's not just in the Clean Water Program. It's in the Clean Air Program as well. Ms. Kloppenberg submitted the Sierra Club case as additional authority, and even though it doesn't qualify as additional authority and has limited, if any, relevance to this case, one thing it does show is that in that case, DNR had developed a state rule based on federal law and was applying what in essence is the federal BAC, best achievable control technology, requirement in the context of air. Because like the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act is a delegated program. The Hazardous Waste Resource Conservation Act is a delegated program. When DNR does environmental impact statements, by law they follow the federal guidelines. They're called the Council on Environmental Quality, CEQ guidelines. DNR is always applying federal law. DNR is always looking at federal law to amend its rules or to tailor permits. This is nothing new. I'm a little surprised that the issue has even come up, but that's based on my experience. I think that, though, that the panoply of statutes and cases and record in this case demonstrate that this is a novel issue never before used by DNR as a barrier to evaluate permits.
Well, let me give you this potential reaction. DNR is a public agency, of course. It is a governmental agency. It has political considerations. And all these permittees out there are working with the DNR to get permits. And when they get those permits, then what you're advocating seems to be that third parties can go in and attack the permits. Why shouldn't I feel that the permittees as a class would view your position as sort of destabilizing their position?
The position we're advocating is fundamental to the transparent government that has been established in Wisconsin, and quite frankly, the transparency required by federal law as a condition of delegation. Whatever DNR does, whether it favors or harms a prospective permittee, whether it grants a license or denies a license, has to be open to public scrutiny. It has to be. And if someone disagrees, they have to have the opportunity to say, DNR, you're not following your own legal requirements. It is a fundamental check in the system, just as judicial review of administrative activities through Chapter 227 is a fundamental check in the system. It is the way it has always been since these statutes were first created and DNR agreed to administer this program in 1974. Nothing has changed in that regard. I'm not sure if that answers your question, sir.
What's driving the DNR position, then?
I did ask that question, and I did not get a response, Your Honor, so I really don't understand, and I don't think it's for me to say.
Okay. Counsel, I just want to check that I understand you. 283.63, which is a review of permits under
yes.
the state law, it says who can review, the applicant, the permittee, the state, might be a different state, right?
Correct.
Because the water might flow somewhere else.
or five or more persons.
Correct.
Is that required by the federal law that non-permittees, people who are interested in clean water, that's what this is, right? I mean, you don't have to show that, but that's, is that required by the federal law?
I know there is a corresponding federal statute that allows review and hearing on federally issued permits. I'm struggling in my mind whether that is a requirement that transfers to the state or whether it is the only the opportunity for a notice and comment and a so-called informational hearing that transfers to the state.
But no one's arguing that these people don't have the right to a contested hearing under state law.
Correct.
Or that the state law violates a federal law by giving them an opportunity.
Correct.
No one's challenging that.
Correct.
So under the state statute, the state legislature has opened this up to, if you'll pardon the expression, do-gooders, even though they may not have a personal stake of being in the water and being directly affected, other than as people, we all are affected by water and air.
It's not always do-gooders, if you will, Your Honor.
Well, we don't want do-batters, do we?
Well, it happens. There are times when hearings are requested by competitor entities.
Okay.
I got a tougher permit than you did. And so it creates a competitive disadvantage. So that happens as well. It also happens that...
they fit under any permit applicant? Or do they fit under five or more persons?
I think it's typically done as the five.
Okay. Right?
There are also times when municipalities, again going under the five, will seek review because it has an impact on regional or local water management plans. So it's not always neighbors, it's not always public interest groups, it's everybody has this same right, whether you're a permittee, another public agency, or, you know, what you characterized as do-gooders. So I was on the topic of I'm done.
You may summarize your statement or give a final concluding statement.
I have not really addressed the issue directly of why the state process versus the federal process, but I would turn the court's attention to the American Paper Institute case, 890 Fed Second, 869, particularly at pages 874 and 875. And the point I want to make on that is, and then I only have one other point, if I may, Your Honor. The point I want to make on that is that some of these older cases, Save the Bay, the Washington State case that the industrial amici cite, they're no longer good law. They were, to the extent they create avenues of review, they were decided under the prior version of the Federal Clean Water Act. It was amended in 1977, and the 1989 American Paper Institute case out of the Seventh Circuit specifically addresses that, how the law changed and why the result of that is that there is no access, there's no right to federal review, and there's no access to court, whether the federal court reviews or doesn't review, if it doesn't object. And the last point I want to make, Your Honor, and it relates to the same question of why state review and not federal, and it comes from a case that was decided a couple years after American Paper Institute. We didn't cite it because it's the identical same point, and it's sort of on a tangential Clean Water Act issue, but it's at 932 F. Second, 668, Seventh Circuit, 1991, at page 671. It says, environmental laws produce complexities aplenty. We need not read them to produce jurisdictional snarls accompanied by parallel litigation in state and federal courts. And that's the essence of the federal law on access to the federal system. These are state-issue permits. As a matter of state law, they have to comply with federal law in order to get the truly millions of dollars of federal funding that's available to operate the program. And when all is said and done, your avenue of challenge, be it federal law challenges or state law challenges, are through the state system. It's all that the citizens of the state of Wisconsin have in order to question whether DNR is complying with state law that requires minimum compliance with federal law. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sindebrand. Ms. Kloppenberg, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Your Honor, let me start my rebuttal with another example. Another challenge they made concerned whether phosphorus limits should be daily or monthly. EPA's rule prescribes daily limits for pollutants unless those limits are not practicable. That's 40 CFR 122.45 sub D. EPA approved DNR's rules setting a rolling monthly average for phosphorus, i.e. DNR determined by rule that a daily limit is not practicable for phosphorus. This was back then. Of course, it's different now. The Council says that both EPA and DNR are wrong, that it should be daily, that the DNR's rule, which was approved by EPA, is wrong, and EPA wrongly approved it. Whether it is practicable to have a daily or monthly limit for phosphorus at the time was a call that DNR made at the rulemaking stage. And to change that call, which they're seeking here, permit by permit, would subvert and second-guess the state rulemaking process and EPA's approval. The American Paper Institute case doesn't apply here. As an aside, I should say it's telling that the companies in that case went the federal court route. Why didn't they try going to state court to say that the state permits somehow violated EPA's policies? It's because they wanted EPA to change those rules and make DNR change its rules. But they can't do that in the state forum, so they had to go to EPA, and the federal court knocked them out there, too, in that respect. They needed to seek rulemaking changes, not challenge in court those rules. DNR is not saying here that the federal court should review state permits. We agree with the council. That doesn't do anybody any good. But EPA is the only entity that can make Wisconsin rules conform to federal rules. The council has many avenues, or several avenues that they've used to effectuate those changes.
Counselor, I want to be sure that I'm clear on what we are being asked to decide. And if I understand from the back and forth arguments here as well as the arguments made in the brief, you are not appealing the Court of Appeals decision on what review means and what anew means as terms under 28363. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Just so I'm sure.
Right.
Thank you.
To answer the questions that were asked about what rights of review the federal laws allow, Section 1 in 40 CFR 12411, that requires a state to allow notice and comment in a public hearing, not a contested case hearing, the kinds of things that happened here before the final permit was issued. Section 123.30 of the 40 CFR requires that there be a right to judicial review. There's no federal right to a contested case hearing. That's something that the DNR has put in place. 28363 is a state law creation.
Counsel, let me make sure that I understand this at its essence. Your position is that the DNR does not have authority to determine whether the proposed or whether a proposed permit complies with the federal requirements at a hearing. Is that correct?
At a contested case hearing,
at a contested case hearing.
Yes.
That you have no authority at a contested case hearing to entertain arguments about what federal law means. Is that correct?
Correct. What general federal law means, yes.
And yet, state law requires that your permits can only be issued if they are consistent with, you know, reach the minimum of federal law and are not more stringent than.
The statute says our rules must be consistent and no more stringent, except for exceptions like actually phosphorus. The old rule for phosphorus was a state rule. There was no federal rule at the time.
So your position is if the application of the rule, someone says the application of the rule violates federal law, there's no opportunity for hearing on that.
They can't do that because if they are saying that the rules that the terms comply with state law, then the terms can only be invalid if they are inconsistent with federal law because they are consistent with the state rules.
Well, not all state rules are necessarily consistent with federal law.
And then there are challenges to the rules. And here, too, when they, in the record, when you look at their comments to the DNR at the proposed permit stage, they specifically said the standard in the permit, which is word for word the standard in the rule, like this monthly average instead of a daily average, that violates federal law. They're saying the rules violate federal law here.
What is the forum for redress if someone is challenging and saying the application of your rules is inconsistent with the application of your rules, which lends to this permit, is inconsistent with federal law?
They can ask EPA to object to the permit.
Yeah, but the timing doesn't work. You've got only a 30-day opportunity for public comment, and then that's the end. And 90 days, as I understand it, is the period of time that EPA has to object. And I don't know how you fold 90 days into 30 days when you have 1,000 applications from Wisconsin alone.
But if you are making a comment on the permit in that 30-day public comment period, you can copy it to EPA and say, EPA object if this comment's not changed. It doesn't require extra effort. My time is up.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you, Ms. Kloppenberg, and thank you, Mr. Sindebrand, for your very helpful arguments on a case that involves, for the court, readily familiar law about deference, readily familiar law about statutory powers, and a very unfamiliar law of the federal government and state relating to the Clean Water Act. So I think it's been very enlightening. That concludes our hearing on 08-AP-3235, Kurt Anderson versus Department of Natural Resources. The students may remain if they can. Justice Crooks will be right out to discuss the procedures of the court, and the court will reconvene at 1:30 for its third and final argument for the November calendar. The court's in recess until 1:30.